Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Writer's Routine podcast. My name is Dan Simpson. Now, this is the show where we investigate what makes creatives tick. Just realised, investigate's a pretty strong word. I mean, I'm sitting down interviewing them, asking them questions, not hiring a private investigator. Anyway, on the show, we're finding out how authors work, specifically how they manipulate their time to get maximum efficiency from their idea, really. Because it's worth remembering, loads of people write you right now. You might have an idea, you might have plots, you might have characters in your head that maybe at a push one day you might write a little book about. Now, we're finding out on the show what gives writers the motivation to get it down on paper and then the dedication to finally get it published. Very simply, we're discovering the diary of their day. Speaking of diaries, we've got another weird and wonderful routine from history with our Distinguished Diaries feature a little later. Today, it's about, well, when you imagine the romantic ideal of a writer, you know, booze-soaked nights in the jazz clubs of Paris in the 20s, penning the great novel, you think of this guy, and we'll find out the way he worked a bit later. First, it's to our guest, who was tasked with bringing back Dennis the Menace. Stephen Butler is a polydoer. Is that a word? For a podcast about writing, I feel I should know more words. Anyway, Stephen Butler does a lot of stuff. He is an author, a playwright, a singer, an actor, a cook. I follow him on Twitter, right? And he lives the life that I imagine I lead, but I patently don't. You know those kind of people, don't you? You know, their social media presence always makes you think you should be more active and less slobbing about on the sofa than you really are. But you can't get annoyed with the guy. Stephen is a lovely chap too. I mean, he's a huge deal in kids' writing as well. If you've got kids, they probably know who he is. He's been writing books for about 7 years now, and his Wrong Pong series was nominated for the Roald Dahl Funny Prize, which then got him the esteemed and no doubt daunting task of writing adventures for Dennis the Menace. And he invited me to his flat in North London, where his dog was too, so you might hear him panting and puffing away, where I was very interested in his writing routine, specifically how it has changed from his first book to his last, because he's had quite a lot published in just a short handful of years.
I think my 15th comes out this year, so I've got a few out there already.
So what I was thinking is, I thought we'd kind of look at both your first book,
yep,
and how you, what you did with that, and then your most recent book.
Yeah.
So I guess most recently then, describe to me the scene when you're sat down and you're writing your book. What are you looking at?
Well, I mean, I work, it's very inauspicious circumstances. I've got a desk in my bedroom, so it's pretty much kind of roll out of bed in my pyjamas. And I have a rule now. This is very different. When I first started, I had no idea what I was doing, and I worked all over the place, and I was distracted. And there would be some days when I would do a couple of thousand words, and another day when I would do two. And so I'm much stricter with myself now, and I set myself a really low target. So I do 500 words a day, which is not that much, but enough that it racks up quickly, and that's my minimum. So as long as I've done my 500 words, if I am distracted, I can go and do something else, but or I can just keep going, and I can do, you know, I on a good day I can do 5,000 words, but as long as I've got my 500 words, I'm all right. It's like, and that means I get my books finished on time.
Are you trying to make them good 500 words, though? Or are you just, for want of a better phrase, you're just churning stuff out?
I tend to, I pride myself in putting together a pretty good first draft. So I kind of edit as I go, I suppose, a bit. But the best bit of advice I was ever given, which was years ago when I wrote my first book, was just write a terrible first draft. Because if you write a terrible first draft, you can make a terrible first draft into an amazing second draft. But one of the biggest problems is that there are so many writers out there that think it has to be pristine on the first go, so they never finish their first draft. There's all these unfinished books. So it's much better to have a finished, terrible first draft than an unfinished, pristine first draft that you never finish, because it's, you know, it'll take you 10,000 years to get there. So I'm a believer in editing. Get the first draft done and then make the second draft fabulous.
So talk to me more about your boring bedroom where you're writing this. Are you writing it by hand? Are you writing it on a computer? What are we doing?
Never by hand. Never by hand. I'm terrible. I've got the scruffiest handwriting ever, and I'm really slow. I've got a desktop Mac, and I sit there and tippy type away, and I tend to do it kind of. Weirdly, when I first started, I always wrote at night. I would have my day and then go to my desk about 9-ish and stay there till midnight. And now I tend to pretty much get up and just make a coffee and go straight to my desk and just have it done. And then you kind of get the whole of your day and you can relax, going, right, I've made my, you know, I've made my contribution to the book for the day.
I'm going to quickly read through your Twitter bio, if that's okay.
Sure.
Well, not in detail, but you are a busy man.
Yeah,
Stephen. So
I'm a fidget.
So you're an actor, you do voiceover stuff, you're a playwright, you're a singer, and you're an author. Talk me through your busiest day that you can remember when you still managed to cram in some writing.
The busiest I've ever been was a couple of years ago. I was writing the second Dennis the Menace book, and I was in a show, so I was performing every single day, and there was a mistake with the commission, and there was a delay on it, and I ended up having to write a whole book in 3 weeks. When I'd go on stage, do a scene, run off, type a few more words, and that was insane. I made myself like ill doing that, but that's kind of normal for me. Like I've written a lot of books in a lot of dressing rooms, like particularly the Dennis books. There's 6 of those. A lot of those I wrote in my dressing room, on iPads and laptops and, yeah, whatever I can kind of... Sometimes even on my iPhone, in notes on your iPhone, just typing away.
So how do you compartmentalise it, though? If you've got so many different creative kind of things going on, acting, writing, how do you possibly manage to switch on the different types of your brain when you're coming off stage and you need to bash out another 100 words?
I think timetabling works, which is why I'm now... like I get up and I go, right, I'm going to write. My morning brain is going to be writing. So I do that, but yeah, I think you just get used to it. I mean, I've got a bit of a brain like that anyway, so it's just something I'm relatively comfortable with, being quite scatty. But you just learn to just switch from one to the other, and just like one hat off, one hat on.
What do you say to relatives when they ask you what your job title is?
Well, they know. I mean, like, all of my relatives know what I do. I think they just think I'm a bit nuts. When things are calm, I can write in the day and perform in the evening. So I don't have to. I don't say I'm more of a writer or I'm more of an actor rather. So I can juggle them quite comfortably. So I'm an actor author, I suppose. Neither one really dominates the other, which is quite nice.
Well, I always enjoyed. I think it was Stephen Fry who says, you know, human being is a verb. Mm. So we're just being. We're just doing things.
Yeah.
I kind of like that. Let's go back to your first book then. What was your very first book that you got published?
First book was The Wrong Pong for Puffin Books.
How many years ago was that now?
6 years ago, I think.
So talk me through what you can remember of the writing of that book. When was the first moment you had that idea?
I was playing years and years ago. I played Horrid Henry on stage. And it was that sparked my interest in children's books, because I was actually writing a book. I was writing an adult fantasy novel, which I've still got somewhere, and it's absolutely awful. It was about a town that was a town of humans that was in the belly of a giant sea monster, but they had no idea they were in the belly of a giant sea monster.
It's very Plato's Cave.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, but it's awful. I read it back now and it's so earnest, and there's like 20,000 adjectives per line. Like, it's awful. But But so I knew I wanted to be a writer, and again, I was doing that thing. I'd been working on it for about 2 years, and I think I'd maybe got 3 chapters out, because I was doing that thing where I couldn't finish a chapter until it was perfect, or what I thought was perfect. Yeah, and so I was on stage playing Horrid Henry on tour, and so that I got to know children's books, and I also got to know Francesca Simon, who's a brilliant, you know, famous children's writer who writes them. And so that was really the start of my interest, and I was like, I'm going to try and do this. And yeah, and then the Wrong Pong just kind of happened. I don't remember how long it took me to write, because it was just kind of, I had the idea and then kind of it was finished. But it probably took me the best part of about 6 months to write, I think.
And how were you writing now? So you said that you think you were doing it at night. Is that what was happening?
Yeah, pretty much. It's a long time ago, and I've written so many books that it all kind of blurs into one. But yeah, mostly because I was very, very poor and working like day jobs then, because I was a poor actor. And so I was definitely kind of writing in little snatches. So not necessarily just at night, but in little bits. Yeah, we finally got it finished. And then I had a very lucky moment where my literary agent had decided that she was not taking on any more clients. That was it, until she retired. And then we met and we got on, and she said no. I asked her and she said no. And then about, I don't know, a couple of months later, she's incredibly sweet. And she was like, you know what? I've changed my mind. I want to champion one last author. So she took me on, and that was it, really. And it happened really quickly. I was really lucky. Some people, you know, they finish their book and it takes a long time. And I think it took 3 months for Puffin to pick it up. So I was really lucky. My manuscript landed on the desk of Elv Moody, who at the time was the editor-in-chief of Puffin. And so I had the editor-in-chief doing my books, and it was one of those really, the planets really did align. So as much as I think it would have been published, there is a lot of luck in that happened then. Yeah, definitely, definitely.
So what do you think you've learnt then, 15 books later, about how you work best, about what works well when you're writing, about how you do things?
I think you need to treat it like work. And that sounds really boring, and it's what a lot of people don't want to hear. And I think one of the greatest enemies of finishing a book and becoming an author is being overly romantic about the act of being a writer. You find a lot of people don't really want to write; they just want to be a writer. And so, like, I've met quite a few people that can't write unless they pay for a flight to go and work in some, you know, Romanian medieval library, vaulted library somewhere, writing with a feather quill. And it's like, no, you've just got to, you know, you've got to take the romance out of it, and you've got to treat it like work, and you've got to sit down and you've got to do it, which is a really boring answer. And I say that to people, and I think a lot of people want to be told that there is like a secret talisman, or this secret incantation or something, but it's not. It is sit down, and sometimes it's boring and sometimes it's stressful, but you just got to do it. It's like any other job.
We'll have more from Stephen Butler a bit later, where we'll talk about how he moves his ideas onto the page, how he makes things funny for a discerning kids' audience, and how an old headmaster gave him the inspiration to become an author. We've also got a distinguished diary from history in just a sec with one of the most famous authors of the 20th century. First, I want to say thank you. Thank you to you for listening. Cheers. You've taken a gamble on something new. You've clicked download. You've found the time to listen. I really appreciate it. It would be amazing to know that you're there as well, liking it. Fingers crossed that you are. So if you can, drop me a review on iTunes. It's dead easy. Just leave me a star rating. Write a few words about what you think about it. Then it'll help the show grow, and we can get more writers and other creative people involved. And also, if you want to shout me anything, maybe tell me someone that I should chat to, give me a question for an author, the email address is writersroutine@gmail.com. There's no apostrophe in writers, by the way. It doesn't work with emails. I know, it's a faff. Anyway, it's writersroutine@gmail.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Time for Distinguished Diaries, then, where we look at a weird and wonderful writer's routine from history. Today, it's F. Scott Fitzgerald. The research for this, by the way, was taken from Mason Curry's book Daily Rituals, which, if you're into this kind of stuff, I absolutely implore you to buy. It's brilliant. Now, Fitzgerald, right, is probably most known for The Great Gatsby. He also wrote three other novels, published quite a few short stories as well. He's also known for his marriage to Zelda Fitzgerald, and together they spent most of their time writing, dancing, and doing loads of drinking. What's interesting, though, is that although we do remember him for his gregarious social activities, he always showed remarkable self-discipline, which was drilled into him while he enlisted in the army, because while he was there, at just 21 years old, he wrote a 120,000-word novel in just 3 months. Now, out of the army, his work keeping to strict deadlines and schedule was a little less diligent, because while living in Paris with his wife in the 1920s, apparently he woke at 11 in the morning, around about then. Then he tried to start writing at 5 p.m, and he worked on and off until 3:30 the next morning. Apparently, though, he didn't actually do work for a lot of this time. Instead of writing, he would go out and get drunk and go dancing with his wife Zelda again. Perhaps, though, the reason that he wrote so many short stories, and I mean even The Great Gatsby isn't that long, it's because his most productive writing would happen in spontaneous bursts of fierce creativity and frenzied output, where he could write up to 8,000 words in a single session. Fitzgerald would try and crack out a story in 3 days, right? He would blast out the words, then he would add a fourth day on the end to revise the story before sending it out for publication. Now, he didn't really get on with longer novels because he truly believed that slamming straight gin helped him be most creative and productive. Yeah. This only worked to a point, though, when even then he realised it wasn't helping, so he tried to keep a part of the day working sober, and I mean, you can guess it rarely ended up that way. And finally, he admitted that it has become increasingly plain to me that the excellent organisation of a book, or the finest perceptions and judgments in time of revision, do not go well with liquor. Still, this was the guy who wrote perhaps one of the greatest books of the 20th century. We can forgive F. Scott Fitzgerald for being a little bit absolutely hammered when he picked up a pen. Back to our guest on the writer's routine now. We're talking to kids author Stephen Butler about the way he organises a creative work day. Now, we'll get to what gave him the inspiration to start writing in just a sec. Quick warning, though, I may get a bit sycophantic and fawning. I'm sorry for that right now. Honestly, I really love the man. Mainly because I'm fascinated at how he doesn't just write his own ideas. He's commissioned by others to write theirs, like he did with the Dennis the Menace stories that he's done. And I'm interested if he plans things differently for separate types of work. So I asked him about it.
I suppose the two parts of that are writing on spec, where you sit in your room and you write a book solely for yourself and you go, I'm going to write this to the best of my ability, and then you try and sell it once it's finished. Or once you've developed a relationship with a publisher and they know your work. So things like Dennis, when I did the Dennis the Menace books, they just came to me and commissioned it. I had no idea. It was very funny. I'd convinced myself. My editor came to me and said, we've got a really exciting project for you, but I can't tell you what it is yet. I'm going to tell you in 2 weeks' time. And at that time, Puffin were commissioning all these sequels to classics. And it was around the time it was going to be published, they told me when the book would be ready, was like the, I can't remember, the something anniversary, I can't remember what it was, of the BFG. And I convinced myself, I mean, it's so unrealistic, but I convinced myself they were going to ask me to write a sequel to the BFG. And then my editor called and was like, right, are you ready? And I was like, yes. And she was like, Dennis the Menace. And I was like, I mean, I love Dennis the Menace, but I was like, oh, I wasn't ready for that. But the two ways of commissioning really are either that you've developed a relationship with a publisher, or you are known enough by other publishers that they know your work, which happens through just developing a career, or working on spec and writing your own stuff. And I mean, my biggest advice would always, you have to have an agent. A lot of publishers won't look at unsolicited manuscripts. So,
I was looking through one of your Dennis books earlier today, and they're unlike any book I read when I was a child, in that, and this isn't meant in a bad way at all,
yeah.
But it's very stylistic, it's huge, like it's big words across pages, yeah. You've got illustrations in there as well. But the language, because I guess you've got to be fairly economical,
yeah.
With how many words you're writing.
Yeah.
How much thought goes into making sure this word is the best word that can be used at that point?
Enough. It's definitely on my mind. But you also remember that you'll always do probably one or at least two or three edits. So that's normally something that comes after the structure of the book is there. But
do you write with the structure of the physical book in mind, as in, do you know that it's going to be a bit funny with the font, that you're going to have illustrations all over it?
That's normally no. Dennis was a brilliant exception. I really loved doing it. Dennis was the only book I've ever done, and not because anyone else is wrong or bad, but as in, it just doesn't happen, where I would actually write on the manuscript. So I would write his words, and then on the manuscript I'd go, right, here in this picture you're going to do this, and I had total control over what the page was going to look like. I mean, obviously then it goes to the illustrator and he has his artistic control of drawing it, but normally you would never do that. You just write the manuscript, and then the publisher later, way down the edit, decides what pictures you're going to have, where they're going to go. That's something that happens way down the line. But Dennis, in the original first draft that I hand in, I've got all of the pictures listed, how it's going to be on the page, what's going to go here, this gag. Because the one thing I liked with Dennis is that I was able to get some visual gags that weren't in the words. So, and you just can't do that without me having the control of saying, okay, this is how this is going to work.
How thoroughly do you then have to plan a book like that, knowing exactly what plot point is coming where?
Oh, see, again, it comes down to the writer. You know, people like J.K. Rowling, for instance, is famous that she's plotted like what colour the wallpaper is. She knows everything. But I actually hate planning, because what I've learned is that when I plan, I know how I want to finish the book. But if I sit down and write a big arc and plan it all, I don't follow it anyway. So I'm very much a kind of, I write the first line and I see where it takes me. Well, like a good example of that is that I've just finished my latest book, which I'm really excited about, and I think it's the best thing I've ever written. I bet it's hard to say when it's your own work, but I think it is. But that was commissioned. They wanted 12,000 to 15,000 words, and it's now been edited, and it's 25,000 words. So I went over by 10,000 words. But just because I got to my limit, and I was like, I'm not finished. There needs to be more. It needs to be more. And my publisher was brilliant, that they were like, absolutely, totally fine. So I kept going. You have to take all this advice with a pinch of salt, because it's kind of, it comes down to you and your style and the way you work. But for me, I find plotting too much quite restrictive. And restricting. So I tend to just sit down and say, let's see where we go with this. And, you know, and then surprising things happen.
How often does it surprise you?
Oh, loads. I'm a big believer in literary carrion. I pick things apart. And so things, for instance, like that terrible fantasy novel that I was writing, in the third Wrong Pong book, they get swallowed by a sea monster, and it's the same name. It was called a Gundiscump. And it's basically, I stole all of it. I picked the ribs of that apart, and so it was like, what can I take? What can I take? What can I take? And that became something else. And
so did you think about, I'm so glad that you've mentioned that, because as soon as you spoke about your failed adult novel, I was like, well, when's this appearing?
Always, yeah. I mean, throw them on a pile and pick them apart. Like, just be a vulture, you know, go in there and see what you can pick out of other things. And for instance, in this newest book that I've just finished, there's a bit of a B-line plot, which was actually another book that I wrote. And then discovered, after I was very proud and finished this, I did a 4-chapter treatment and took it to Puffin and was like, look, I've written this new book. And my editor's face dropped and she was like, we're about to publish almost the exact same book. And somebody else had written it and got there before me. Like, almost, it was awful, like almost to the exact plot points. But there were certain characters and things like that. And so they went on the carrion pile and I've picked them back out and they've appeared in other places. And
I guess, writing as an adult, are you conscious of where the book may be read? For instance, if it's a bedtime story, do you ever think about putting a little nod and a wink to the parents as well while they're reading?
I don't really think about that. I do that anyway. I have quite a violent sense of humour, and I always push it. My editors are always like, you can't say that, and things. So I always try to put in a little bit of kind of adult humour that the parents will pick up on. I don't really think so much about when it will be read, really. It's more just that it will be read. And for me, it's just as long as I can tell a good story. I suppose, in a way, a good story will be read in all circumstances, whether you're in the car or at bedtime or on holiday. So I think for me, I don't really think about when or where. It's just about as long as I feel that it's good, I suppose.
I guess that leads into my next question. You're a big part of World Book Day and the celebrations there. How much responsibility do you feel now as a children's author? Is it not just that you're writing books for kids, but you're trying to get kids reading, you're trying to keep the reading,
absolutely.
So your books need to be really exciting so they don't put it down?
I'm really passionate about literacy, and mostly because I was illiterate. I was the worst when I was a child. Not only was it that I was terrible at reading, I hated it. I mean, I really hated books, which is that's normally my opening gambit whenever I do a book event. You see all the parents gasp when an author gets up on stage and talks about how much he hates books. So I found that I quite enjoyed the anarchic side of that, because if you read the Dennis books, the whole way through it, all he does is talk about how terrible books are. And I love the kind of, there's something about seeing a kid desperately reading to the end of a page and turning the page to read more about how rubbish books are when they're reading books. It's kind of, it feels quite, I don't know, there's something really naughty in it, which I love. But when I started primary school, we had a headmaster, and then he was quite old and retired, I think, and left. And this new guy came, and it was Jeremy Strong, the children's author.
Yes, so Jeremy Strong is just, his book's in my brother's bottom.
Famous Bottom,
Brother's Famous Bottom, that's the one, yeah.
And it was like having Willy Wonka as a headmaster. And we, you know, he just arrived one day. And, you know, when you're a kid, you're like, oh, yeah, that's the new headmaster. And we just, I mean, the whole school just fell madly in love with him. He was just brilliant. And so that was definitely the start of my reading life. Because before he came along, I just hated books. I hated books. I thought they were awful things. And it was Jeremy that taught everyone that books were funny. And because, you know, I mean, things have changed a lot. But when I was a kid and we had these awful reading schemes it was about these kids, and they were so unoriginal. There was Billy Blue Hat, Roger Red Hat, Jennifer Yellow Hat, and somebody else.
You see, I had Biff, Chip and Kipper.
Oh, yeah. See, they came.
The Magic Key?
Yeah. They came later. I'm older than you. Okay. So, yeah. And I mean, I would love to, if I ever found out who wrote them, I would love to go and commit violent acts upon them. They were just awful. And so as my little child brain, I just thought books were terrible. And so learning that they were funny and rude, and Jeremy's, that I can't say because it's in my brain now, but I'm sure he had a big effect on me, because, you know, he wrote these brilliant, really rude, naughty books. Somewhere subconsciously that affected me as a writer.
How much thought goes into the actual jokes? I know that you said that you never use your pen. Do you ever find yourself having ideas walking down the road that you need to jot down?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. For things like that, I tend to, if I've got an idea on the tube or on the bus or something, I just type it into my phone. If anyone ever, if I lost my phone and they found my phone, they would think it was belonged to a madman. I definitely tend to be a bit of a magpie. I see things all the time and just go, I like that. I'm going to write that down and remember this. And, you know, the new book I've got, it's going to be a big one. And in terms of the characters, it's a bit like the Ben-Hur, like children's equivalent of Ben-Hur. It's got a lot of characters. So, naming them, I'm really passionate about good names, and I love that. And I different writers have different things, but I can't really tell you about my character until I know what their name is. That's when their kind of personality arrives. And so I see things all the time on road signs, or strange words, or things in delis, you know, some odd piece of meat or something, and I just write them down all the time. I'm constantly stealing. I'm an absolute magpie.
Well, there you go. That was my chat with Stephen Butler. Hope you enjoyed it. If you've got kids, I can't recommend his Wrong Pong and Dennis the Menace books enough. You see, for various reasons, I've read a fair amount of kids' books, and his are absolutely streets ahead of the rest. So that's it then for another episode of The Writer's Routine. Thanks for listening. We're back next week with a crime author who turned an episode of online trolling that she received into a series of best-selling books. And she's big into the idea as well of a daily ritual, so make sure you give that a listen. And remember, you can send me a message with anything you fancy over to writersroutine@gmail.com, no apostrophe, and do leave us a review on iTunes if you can. That's it then. I'll see you next week. Bye!
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.